Okay, folks, welcome once again. This is Elvin Shamrock here to our bi-weekly teleseminar. And fortunately, in sharp contrast to 2 weeks ago, I understand we have two active participants who have volunteered, and they submitted some questions and case list issues that they had, and we're going to discuss them. And they really are very good issues, and we can have a wholesome discussion. So I will share with you, because we get new people joining us every single time we have a teleseminar throughout the year, that this is totally unscripted. I just got the email from my office today, and I've got a good idea of what issues have to be discussed, but it really is totally unscripted, and we'll see where the conversation takes us. So let's just see, Rebecca, our first volunteer. Rebecca, are you there? Can you just say hi, Rebecca?
Hey, I'm here.
Thank you so much for volunteering. I really appreciate it. And then our second volunteer is Lindsay. Lindsay, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
And to you too. Thank you so much for volunteering. So, Rebecca, let's start with you. And I've got the email in front of me with the story of the case, but I want you to present it for everyone, the sake of everyone listening in. And whenever I ask you to do this, please understand, it's really important that you folks should practice. Now's a good opportunity, but also when you're in the hospital, when you're chatting and discussing cases with your friends and colleagues, it's important to get the case across in as a succinct, short fashion as possible, only giving the relevant information and not the nonsense peripheral to the issue. And if you can do this, and it's not difficult, and most of us are pretty good at it, let me put it this way, if you can't do this, it stands out, and it leaves the examiner listening to you with the thought that this candidate is having difficulty determining what's important and what's not important in a particular case. So I want to emphasize this, and you should use this as an opportunity to do the best you can. And as the weeks and months roll by, we will all hear examples of people doing a better job, some are not such a good job. But I just want to share with you, it's really important that you get the presentation over with in as quick and simple, effective way as possible. So I hate to prefix your presentation, Rebecca, like that, but give it your best shot for the sake of everyone listening in. Tell us about this case that you've got, and then we can chat about it.
Okay. She is a 29-year-old G8P4 who states to be 29 weeks of gestation, who presents in active labor, history of polysubstance abuse and scant prenatal care, actively high. Had to recently use IV fentanyl before being dropped off. She had a history of 3 prior vaginal deliveries and 1 cesarean. Her most recent cesarean was 5 years ago. Upon presentation, I'm called to the room because she's in significant pain, saying she's going to drop the baby, but I've had a C-section and I want another one. So I scanned her, check position, baby's cephalic.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Sure.
I want, when you're presenting, to try and avoid slang. So
okay.
you just said she was going to drop the baby, and there's some ambiguity there. That's number one. Number two, try and avoid that kind of language. please understand, folks, when I can critique you folks like this, at the end of the day, if you say occasionally a word that's slang, for example, you're not going to fail. But it's my job to make you as good as you possibly can be. So I'm going to critique you from every angle. And if you can only get 50% of what I'm suggesting driven into you, well, that's 50% more than you were before. So I want to put it into context. Yeah, try and avoid slang. But if you use a slang word, I don't want you in the exam to say, oh, I apologize, I used the wrong word. Just carry on. It's not the end of the world. I want you right now to strive for perfection. And if you don't reach perfection in the exam, but you're just exceptional or even just decent, that's also okay. But I'm purposely keeping the bar high as we prepare for the exam. Sorry to interrupt you, Rebecca. Go ahead. What did you mean by drop the baby?
So I the patient said that. So that was just more of a clarity of her sense of urgency as to the fact that she was going to have a baby precipitously. So that's how I took that when she said that. So I was
fine. I wasn't sure what you meant, honestly. But okay, I'm from the old school.
Well,
what can I tell you?
No, it's okay. So I'm at bedside. I'm scanning. Baby is cephalic. I'm discussing with her, have you had any leaking of fluid? No. I go to perform a speculum knowing she's very uncomfortable, but at least try. I didn't see placenta when I scanned. And upon even just spreading labia, her water broke. And she was about +2 gestation when I checked. She was complete, +2, very uncomfortable. And at that point, I recommended we proceed with a vaginal delivery. She claims to be 29 weeks. I have nothing else to state otherwise. In our electronic medical record system, we couldn't see anything, even in the tab that allows us to look at other facilities. At the time, our midwife was checking this while I was dealing with the patient. I recommended a vaginal delivery. Given her history of successful vaginal deliveries, she was a good candidate for a TOLAC, but she adamantly declined that. So at that point, unknown gestational age, knowing this baby was low, I quickly consent her on the risks of fetal and maternal morbidity and mortality, given how low we were stationed, and she very much wanted the cesarean, so we went back.
I've got to interrupt you for a second. How? And I'm being picky now, and I'm going to take you at your own words. How do you consent a patient, and how relevant is her signature when she is, by your own words, high?
I think...
Do you understand the issue from the examiner's point of view? It's probable that you've got a decent explanation, but you've said something that is potentially problematic, and you may have a good way out of it. That's fine, but I want you and everyone listening in to realize. Try, in general, to avoid this kind of situation, try and be consistent throughout. Here we have a potential contradiction. So I'm just throwing it out at you, Rebecca. Explain this.
Absolutely. Yeah, so a patient still has a right to make her own decision. Yes, she was on IV fentanyl, but she very clearly looked at me and said, I do not want a vaginal delivery. I want a cesarean. And at that point, patient has a choice. A patient has a choice to electively have a cesarean if she were to come in as a G1P0 at 5 centimeters dilated, a perfect candidate.
At what point does the Good Samaritan's law come in? And if she takes a good look at you and says, I want X, and you know that X is a major life threat to the baby and or herself, at what point would you say, I'm going to ignore her, and I'm going to do what is, in my opinion, as the professional, the right thing? You see what I'm doing. I'm not letting you go. I'm not letting you off the hook.
Yeah.
I'm pushing you with your back to the wall. I want you to confront the issue. And just by the way, when if and when the examiner does this kind of thing, they're not trying to paint you into a corner. In the majority of cases, you can say anything. You can take any defense, this side or that side. As long as you can give a reasonable defense of your proposed approach, that's fine. And that's what the examiner is pushing for. So I'm still, I haven't let you go yet on this issue.
Yeah.
What happens if it's not a question of vaginal delivery versus toe-lac versus C-section? What if it's an issue of something more major that she's just making a potential bad decision? Would you override her, or would you ignore her position if she's high?
I think in this case in particular, her her being high was definitely a part of my decision-making process. I think it was more of her history of having had a cesarean, and should she have clearly declared, I want a C-section, I ignore her, and she ruptures her uterus, again, at a gestational age that I think she's 29 weeks, or she refuses to push and she's so low, she's too early for me to use a vacuum or anything to help me deliver this baby. So I was caught very quickly in a, what is the safest, most legal way to do this? Should I want to do what I want to do, and things go south, right? And the patient
did she land up having a repeat C-section?
She ended up having a repeat C-section, yes.
Okay. So it turns out in this case, what she was requesting lined up very nicely with what you would have done. So that makes it easy. But regardless of that, I would say the way you defended your decision was actually very good. And that's absolutely fine. At that point, if I were the examiner, I'd back off on this issue and we'd move on to the next one. Okay? So I just want you folks to be aware of when you say something that piques the examiner's curiosity, there's going to be a comeback question to seek clarification. And we've now clarified and we're good to go. So you've done well so far. That's great. Okay, so I interrupted you. I apologize, Rebecca. Carry on with your presentation.
So at that point, we went back for a cesarean. I always pull my midwife with us to do a vaginal hand, knowing how low this baby was in the pelvis. Hold on, let me open this back up. And so we went back. She had general anesthesia. We were able to get into the uterus quite quickly. Her uterus was holding tone. It did not give any relaxation.
Sorry, I didn't hear. Her uterus was holding what? I never.
Tone. It was in a constant contraction. It was.
I got you.
Relaxation.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So looking at the lower uterine segment, I went above the bladder reflection in a true stat fashion. And when I go to open the hysterotomy bluntly, I struggled very hard to get it open enough because of how much she was contracting. Baby was so low. My midwife was giving as much vaginal hand as possible. I tried three times and had my hand low to get the baby out to try and deliver head first through the hysterotomy, and was unsuccessful. At that point, we delivered breech from the hysterotomy, and that was actually much more successful and easier to do. She maybe went off to our nursery team, who was present with our pediatrician. Apgars were 8 and 9. Baby weighed 2,500 grams. We were able to get a 14-week ultrasound, dating the patient at 39 weeks. So baby was growth restricted. Baby was diagnosed with a...
Hold on a second. You said the baby was 29 weeks by date for ultrasound, and it weighed 2,500 grams? Is that correct?
I'm sorry. No. So by the 14-week ultrasound, it was 39 weeks, despite her telling us.
Oh, 39 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm with, okay, fine. Carry on.
We delivered baby breech through hysterotomy. That we were able to get the fetal head out much easier that way. And again, her uterus was giving me no elasticity. And apgars were still good, 8, 9. It was the pediatric nurse who caught, had a deformity on her right parietal area and was diagnosed with a decompression skull fracture and subdural hematoma. She stayed in the hospital for 8 days.
And is that the part of this case that you're worried about? The hematoma and the fracture?
How, and how much detail are they going to go from a pediatric standpoint for me to, I guess that's
okay. Okay. So look, first, this is a great case. You don't have anything to worry about. We're going to discuss it. And you could theoretically, it wouldn't happen in practice. There's so much material here. You could have virtually your entire exam just off this one patient.
Yeah.
So let's go through it. First of all, let me back off. There's a lot going on in this case, but you were long-winded, and if you take away my interruptions, you probably spent about 4 minutes presenting the case. That's way too long. They've only got 30 minutes to ask you about your case list. They're not going to give you 40 minutes on this case.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would encourage you to do, try and determine what do you think is going to pique the examiner's curiosity most likely. And you're probably correct. It's the fracture and the hematoma. So if you think that's the case, in your initial presentation, you can say, look, this was a drug-addicted mother who came in actively high on drugs, fentanyl, and insisting she have a repeat C-section. Despite counseling to the contrary, I went and did the C-section, which was complicated by a very low fetus. I struggled to deliver, and in the end, the only way to do this was through a breech, which I accomplished, and the baby had an apgars of 8 or 9, but was found to have a fracture and a hematoma. So I've kept it as brief as I can, and I'm guessing that took maybe 30 seconds. Now, having said that, if the examiner wants any more information background, you can give it to him. That's fine. But of what you've said, they're probably going to hone in on the hematoma and the fracture. And then they will ask you whatever questions they want. You will answer them, and then that's done. So this is an interesting case. I would encourage you to write it up on paper, making the difficulty with the delivery, the hematoma and the fracture, making that prominent, and everything else, I would minimize it, make it less prominent, or if it's not critical to the case, don't even put it down on paper. So what goes down on paper seems to focus on the major issue of this case. Does that make sense to you, Rebecca?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And then verbally, you'll present it along the similar lines and then follow with whatever the examiner asks you. Now, I want to discuss a few things.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to, with respect to the fracture and the hematoma, and for all of you listening, for Rebecca here, it was a fraction of hematoma. But for the rest of you, pretty much every single one of you have at least one, if not a few more, patients on your list with a complication of significance. And what I'm going to tell Rebecca now pertains to this issue of complications and how do you handle them in the exam. So some of you might have a perforated uterus. Some of you may have a bowel injury, a bladder injury, ureteric injury, whatever the case may be. The basic principle is the same. So this is how you handle it. You've got to don't be blasé about having had this complication, but equally I don't want you to be depressed and embarrassed. You should have an appropriate amount of concern as you present this kind of an issue, and you present it in a very matter-of-fact fashion, and then you go on to critique the issue. What do I mean by that? You say, how do you think this happened? And by the way, oftentimes you folks with whatever complication you have on your cases will may not know how it happened. And it's okay to say that. You say in the exam, one of the things that I was thinking of, how on earth did this happen? And I thought it might have been worse, this, that, the next thing. But at the end of the day, I've got to be honest, I'm not sure. I don't know, and I never will know. You can say that. You can talk like that. Because when it's the honest truth, it's the honest truth, and the examiner can understand it and relate to it because he or she would have been in similar situations in their own career, which is a lot longer than yours. So you be comfortable to say, I consider how it might have happened, okay, and give your honest opinion, even if you know or you don't know, say what you think happened. That's the first part. Then once you realize what you were dealing with, in this case, it doesn't pertain, Rebecca, because it's now a pediatric problem. It's not your problem. But in most of the cases, especially G1 surgery complications, if you've got a complication, okay, we all have complications. That's not the end of the world. But now, what are you going to do about it? So how would you manage that complication? And there you just basically give as much of a textbook description of how you deal with that issue. And if you did that, or if you deviated from that, how did you deviate and why? And that's the second part. And then the third part is, okay, you had a complication, you dealt with it, and let's say the patient did fine. The third part is, having had this complication and with the experience that you now have, what would you do in future to avoid a recurrence of such a complication? And you can hypothesize. It might be in a relatively small percentage of cases, you might land up saying, I ask myself, what could I do to reduce the risk of this kind of complication happening in the future? And I think A, B, C, D, E might work. Or you can say, and I've come to the conclusion, there's really nothing I could have done differently. And if you feel this way, if I were to be presented with this same kind of case again in the future, I think I'd be obliged to manage it exactly the same way. You're being open and honest with your examiner. You're actually building your examiner candidate relationship, and you're showing you've got integrity. All of these things are very good things for you in the exam. So does that all make sense to you, Rebecca?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Just a couple of other odds and ends quickly. How much do you need to know about these complications? Not much. The difference between an epidural, what's a subdural versus a subdural. I'm getting confused. The different layers on the skull, on the different membranous layers. Some of the hematomas cross the suture line, and others don't. Be able to say one sentence on that. And outside of the 3 points that I just mentioned, I think that's the extent of what you need to know in that. They're actually not going to ask you that very much. They just want to know, how do you think it happened? Is there anything you can do to avoid it in the future? The other things that you mentioned, you did mention a general anesthetic. The moment you mention anesthetic or epidural, and by the way, it sounds, given that this case was incredibly acute, it sounds to me like a GA was exactly the way to go, although we like to avoid that where possible in OB. But the moment you say the word GA or spinal or epidural, you be prepared to discuss when would you consider one versus the other and the pros and cons. Lastly, since you did a breech extraction through a uterine incision, be able to describe how, because the words are there on your case list basically, how you would do a vaginal breech delivery. You need to know that backwards. Okay?
So that's
that case, Rebecca. It's a very nice case. I wouldn't worry about it. But first of all, did I answer your questions or not? Not really.
No. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's more of those are kind of what I thought. I just wanted to make sure, like, the depth of like how much do I need to follow up with the and how did the baby do? What?
It's nice to be able to say one sentence on what subsequently transpired with the baby. It's nice if you can say it, but nothing more. Don't worry about that.
Okay.
Thank
you so much.
Excellent. Sure. It's a great case, by the way. Oh, just by that, you've got fentanyl, and be able to talk about opiates, methadone, buprenorphine, although that's more of an office discussion, but it might come up tangentially in this case. Okay, Rebecca, well done. Good job. Lindsay, let's carry on with you. You've got several questions. Go ahead and present them to us, and we'll take them one by one.
Yeah, so I have some, like, logistical questions, I guess, first.
Go ahead. Sure.
Well, one thing is that I've sort of heard conflicting information about what cases to include for OB. If you didn't deliver the patient. So, for instance, I have, you know, a practice where we hand over patients all the time, so I'll admit a patient, I'll start their induction, but then I won't end up delivering them. Do I need to include them because I was the admitting physician?
So look, unless it has changed, and I've got to be honest, I can't tell you for a fact this year. It probably has not changed, but you can all check this up in the bulletin for the certifying exam for 2026. It's on the ABOG website. But typically, this is how it works. On the OB side, If it's a totally normal pregnancy and delivery, and the criteria that make it normal are listed in that bulletin. You know, term spontaneous rupture, vaginal delivery, routine antepartum, intra-postpartum course, good outcome baby for mom. You don't have to mention that. Complicated cases, you must mention. Now, if you delivered them, and they're complicated, you must put them down. If you didn't deliver them, the key issue is who did the delivery. So if you didn't do it, but your partner did, your partner, if he or she were taking the exam, if it's a complicated case, would have to list it on his or her cases, but you not, because you didn't do the delivery. Now, with that being said, let's say this patient has lupus in pregnancy. I mean, you can choose whatever you want. And let's say you studied lupus well, you looked it up as you managed this patient. You would love to have a lupus conversation in the exam. This case, strictly speaking, should not appear on your list. But provided by using this case, you don't have a total of only 20 cases that count, I have no problem you using it. If you have very low numbers and you need this case to count towards that minimum of 20 because you don't have 21, then that's a problem, because strictly speaking, this patient doesn't count. So if they were to audit your cases, for example, and they do it routinely, so a small percentage of cases, they would see this is not your case. They would not count it as such. And so you would only have 19 cases on your cases. That would make it inadmissible, and now you've got a problem. So in that situation, I would not encourage you to use it. However, if that is not your situation, and let's say you admitted the patient, or you started the induction, or even admitted it for a UTI in the second trimester, or anything, you can add this case to your list, and you can always write, it's never going to count against you. You can always write SVD in parenthesis by colleague if you want. You don't even have to do that. At least if you don't put it down on paper and they ask you, which they wouldn't even do, did you do the delivery? You say, no, my colleague did the delivery. I did pretty much everything else. What's happened in a situation like this is you've given your examiner an extra case. You've given them more than you need to. I have no problem with that. I have a major problem with giving them less. So if you're supposed to keep a case on your list and you leave it off, that's a red flag, and I would strongly counsel against that. But I have no problem with you giving them more, and I will just tell you, I can just give you my experience. I've been doing this for over 25 years now, giving this recommendation, and I haven't heard of a single case where it even came up at all as an issue in the exam. So again, just to summarize, you can get counts on who did the delivery. You can give them more, but don't give them less. Does that answer that question, Lindsay?
Yeah, I think on the bulletin it said like whoever was primary for their inpatient care, so it just felt vague. So I wasn't.
Let me give you another example. Let's say a patient is admitted for a non-deliverable admission, pyelonephritis in pregnancy, early third trimester bleeding, and she's admitted for observation. Okay, you admit that patient, but she goes home undelivered, and all you did was you saw her for that inpatient that first admission to the hospital. She then spent 4 days or 2 weeks in the hospital, and you never saw her again. Would you include that case? And the answer would be yes. Because in a case like that, when you think about it, 95% of the decision-making is made at the point of admission. So if you did the admission, it's a good idea to put it down, just to give clarification to what the ABOG is saying. Now, if that patient spent 2 weeks in hospital for third trimester bleeding, and you rounded on her once or twice, does that level of involvement rise to the level of having to put it down on your cases? I would argue no, because you weren't the real decision maker in the management of that case. So does that make sense to you, Lindsay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, good. Next question.
I guess so, going to like GYN cases, I operate a lot with my partners, so I assist them on cases. If I'm the assistant on a case, do I list that case? Or I had one case where I was listed as a co-surgeon, so I was curious if I list that case.
It's very similar to what I just told you. If your name appears as the primary doctor taking care of this patient on the hospital administration sheet, for example, then you're responsible. Think of it another way. If, heaven forbid, something were to go south on a patient and she sues, would you be the first person to be sued? And if the answer to that is yes, it goes down. And I've got it here, and what I'm going to share with you now will make some of you a little depressed. Strictly speaking, cases where your partner, they know you're trying to collect cases, so they try and help. I said, "Can come in and scrub with me. You can include this on your list. You're the assistant. You're not the primary surgeon." And so, strictly speaking, that case doesn't count. But like I mentioned on the OB side, if it's a very interesting case. Now, I love complications, okay, because it's easy to predict the questions. It's easy to work out where the conversation's going to go, and you can prepare accordingly. So I would recommend, where you can, if you have a complication, but you're the assistant, ask if you can round on the patient every day. You try, if you know proactively it's going to be a difficult or interesting case, you try and do the H&P. You dictate the op report. You do the discharge summary. And again, it's a case where you're giving ABOG, by putting it down on paper, you're giving them more than they're asking for, not less. So, and you can always say, look, I did virtually everything on this case. So it's the same thing as OB. And I don't mind you giving them more, as long as you're not relying on that particular case as an absolute, you have to have it, because otherwise you don't have 20 cases that count, because then it's a problem. So does that answer that question, Lindsay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, good. Next one. Sure, next one.
And so for one of the GYN categories, I know there's like the routine post-op. I guess I felt like that was kind of vague, and if like someone, a lot of my surgeries are outpatient surgeries. If I see them, you know, for a follow-up and they had an uncomplicated routine post-op course, can they fall into that category, or does it have to be someone that's cared for post-op inpatient?
It's really meant to generate a conversation on post-op and complications, which would typically be on inpatients. So it's a little difficult to use an outpatient for this kind of thing. However, you can take, and as an example, a hysteroscopy case that was done as an outpatient. And you can write there in the complications column, post-op observation for possible water intoxication. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've opened up the door on a water intoxication discussion. And you've got a case in mind. Was there no complication at all in the case that you're thinking about? I'm assuming there was none. It was just standard.
Right, correct.
Okay, so make it a little complicated. Say, let's say it's a laparoscopy case. Post-op day 10, whatever, whenever you bring them back, colon concern for infection or concern for hernia formation or rule out. You see, what I'm saying is I'm introducing a discussion point, and mm-hmm. then you can say, you know, it was bulging a little bit, and when I first saw it, I thought, oh my goodness, maybe this is the suture closing the port tore, and now there's been some herniation through there. But when I examined it, it was really closed. It was just a little bit of swelling, and there was of no concern. You can raise an issue only to knock it down and say it was all okay. But without having something to talk about, you're not really giving your examiner anything, any meat to chew on. So with that one proviso, if you can generate some kind of a discussion, I think then you can use the case. But otherwise, I'll try and stay away from it, from that category at least. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, do you have any other questions?
I do. These two are more case-specific, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
The first one is, so I had a case where I performed a laparoscopic cystectomy, and then she ended up being readmitted with a intra-abdominal abscess. And so when I was trying to kind of list this kind of under a different category, like, does this count as like a wound post-op complication or a pelvic infection? I was like a little bit confused as to where to put it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's an infection. It certainly could be in the differential of a wound infection, pelvic infection. And I can just tell you, I would have no problem. Folks, you just need to find a tangential connection to the category, and you're there. You can use it, okay? In the question you had before, unless you created that tangential connection, there was nothing. You've got to create it at the very least. Yeah, you've got it. You've got an abscess. That's beautiful. Complications are beautiful in the exam. You've got to change your perspective on this, folks, okay? They're your best friend. I'm just sharing that with you. So, yes, the short answer, yes, you can, and I would have no hesitation doing that.
Okay. And then my last question is also about another case similarly. an OB case where I performed an uncomplicated repeat C-section on a patient who ended up having retained products, and then she went back to have two DNCs performed. And after the second DNC developed a pneumonia that she was admitted for, I didn't care for her during those complications. But because I did her C-section, obviously, I'm putting her on my case
list.
And do
Correct.
I put those complications under
yes.
her complications?
You must put the complications out. Because if you don't, it looks like you're trying to hide some theoretically or potentially damaging information. So, yes, you must put it down. How do you put it down? You put it down in the postpartum complications column. You say post-op DNC times two, and there was a third thing you said, two DNCs, and what was the third thing you mentioned?
She developed a pneumonia that she was admitted for.
Yeah, good. Okay. I would write in the complications column, post-op DNC for RET POC times two, and then readmitted for post-POD number, post-op day number seven, whatever, for pneumonia. And you leave it like that. And when the examiner asks you what happened, you say, look, I didn't really manage these cases. They were managed by a colleague. However, if I would have been on call at that time when she presented, this is what I would have done. And you're going to discuss your management and what actually did transpire by your colleague. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Be open and honest. You've got nothing to hide, okay? All right, folks, we're a little over time, but for those of you that are regulars here, I would like to think you saw a difference in the quality of the teleseminar when we've got people that we can actually discuss real-life cases with. So I want to thank both Rebecca and Lindsay. It raises the quality of these sessions. So thank you. I also want to reiterate to everyone, you notice I never mentioned their last names. To be honest, I don't even have their last names. So you don't need to be embarrassed that anyone listening in would know who you are if you screwed up on a case. Because I never mentioned the last name, and you remain anonymous. So I mentioned all of this because I want you to all to volunteer, and if we don't get volunteers like we had the last several sessions, I'm not going to do this. It's not as beneficial. So please, I encourage all of you to volunteer. Send us your interesting cases, your concerning cases. Maybe your complications, you're not sure how to handle them, defend them, and we'll discuss it. And it's good for everyone, not just you. Everyone benefits. I am also, before I finish off, folks, I do once or twice a year, I will ask you if you can do me a favor. Immediately after you hang up, Can I ask you, please, it'll take you 20 seconds, send an email to info@examPro.com. That's info@examPro.com. And all I ask is if you can rate the session that we've just had on a scale of 1 through 5, 1 being lousy, 5 being excellent, please rate how you found the session that we've just had. It helps us tremendously. And in how we tailor these sessions for what you're looking for and what you need. So if you can do that right now, I'd appreciate it. And if you want to add any further comments in addition to just giving a number, we'd appreciate that as well. But if you can just give the number, as I say, that should take no more than 20 seconds to send off that email. and I'd ask you to do it immediately right now, because if you don't do it now, it won't happen. So with that being said, our next teleseminar will be on the 26th of April. That's 2 weeks from today. I want to thank Rebecca and Lindsay once again for volunteering. Thank all of you for joining, and we'll do this all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, folks. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.